One thing to point out from this slide is just that, you know, getting the backstop commitment has a lot of positive implications for the reorganization and the restructuring. The other side of that is if you cannot get the backstop commitment, then your debtor comes out of bankruptcy, perhaps, you know, very hobbled with debt. You might be able to pass the feasibility standard coming out, but you come out with a debtor that simply does not have the type of balance sheet that it can show and market to attract other types of capital if it wants to grow and develop its business. So there's a real upside of getting the capital coming in on the equity side from the rights offering. Likewise, if the rights offering can't be raised, it sends all of the other types of signals to the marketplace.
So we wanted to talk a little bit about what are some of the components of backstop commitment agreements that are common. The biggest piece of that really is the backstop commitment fee. And that's a piece that, again, is heavily negotiated by the parties providing the backstop commitment to compensate them for the risk that they're taking by agreeing to backstop the rights offering. You've typically seen those in the 3-7% range, although certainly in recent cases we've been seeing higher percentages of backstop commitment fees, 8%.
Yep, that's right.
I think I saw 10% in another case I was looking at recently. The commitment fee typically, it can be paid in cash, although oftentimes you see it paid in the form of additional equity. So it's a premium, and it allows those providers who are providing the backstop to purchase that much more equity in the reorganized debtors.
Or you can see, and we saw it in a recent case, the recycling of the cash being paid with the commitment that if the rights offering is approved, yeah, then the cash cycles back in for the purchase.
Right, that's right. Again, as Bill was noting, the backstop can be a critical component of the rights offering to ensure that the debtor can ensure that it's going to raise the capital it needs to both fund claims under a plan as well as fund working capital coming out of Chapter 11. And so for that reason, the backstop fee becomes an important piece of compensating the backstop parties. Another piece of it that's often negotiated, the backstop can be shopped so that if the debtor wants to shop around and find, you know, better offers to backstop the rights offering, they're permitted to do that, but in exchange, the backstop parties usually want a termination fee or a breakup fee. Usually that's paid in cash if the backstop commitment agreement is terminated.
And one of the interesting issues that comes up in this context is that when they look for the backstop commitment and to get parties to participate, you will have some creditors that are happy to step up. You'll have other creditors that simply cannot step up because they do not want to be restricted in their trading of the securities once they have the backstop commitment in place. And then you have the hybrid creditor we'll talk about later, which is they sort of want it both ways, and they're usually what we call the objecting party.
A couple of other provisions to note in backstop commitment agreements. There can be additional incentives for the backstop parties, including oversubscription rights, which allow them to purchase more than their pro rata share of equity if it's undersubscribed, or over-allotment rights, which allow them to purchase additional equity even if it's fully subscribed. And then notably, there's typically heavy negotiation over material adverse event provisions. The backstops are usually committed to well in advance of when the rights offering is actually going to happen and when the securities are going to be issued. And so the material adverse event provisions are negotiated to try to address unforeseen developments that could adversely affect the debtor's business.
And the issuance of securities under the backstop will come one of two ways, depending on how it's priced and how it's funded. You can issue securities under the bankruptcy code under 1145, subject to the restrictions of 1145 on account of claims or interests. You can do, you know, partly cash, but it cannot be dominantly cash. Alternatively, if you can't meet the 1145 factors, and we see this in a lot of matters, you do it under a private placement exemption for two of the Securities Acts that you can put into place. And that way you know you've got it covered both ways for getting your securities issued to your investors going forward. Also, there, in certain circumstances, there will be prohibitions on trading or selling of securities going forward for a period of time to avoid triggering the rules against being an underwriter of securities on the receipt of your securities under 1145.
So just to touch briefly on the 1145 exemption, to qualify for the 1145 exemption, the securities have to be issued under a plan of reorganization, which is typically when you see a rights offering done. Securities have to be issued by the debtor or one of its affiliates or a successor, and either in exchange for claims against or interest in the debtor or, and this is the principally partly that Bill was just getting to, principally in exchange for such claims or interests and partly for cash or property. So there is some wiggle room. It doesn't have to be exclusively in exchange for your claims against the debtor. The principally partly test is not defined like many things in the bankruptcy code. And unfortunately, there's not a ton of guidance. I think it's kind of determined on a case-by-case basis. The SEC has issued no action letters in some cases, but there's not typically definitive guidance on these issues.